And good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are on this rotating globe. And when I talk about the rotating globe, I mean you go to theothersideofmidnight.com and you click on, you know, that link, and it takes you to our homepage. And in the upper right-hand corner, we have what we call our widget. I want to thank Fred for our widget, because our widget allows us to see how many cities we are in all over the planet right now, tonight. And we are in 145 countries, and I cannot count the number of cities, and our numbers are ascending very nicely. So I know a lot of you, because you are in those other time zones, listen asynchronously, which is a translation of you need to be listening to Club 19.5. That is our archive. If you want to hear past shows and hear how past shows connect to current shows, just, you know, go to our homepage and go to the left-hand column, and it will show you how to connect, join, log in, also log in help. So if you want to follow what we're doing, that's probably the best way, because when you're literally all over the world, you are in every time zone, and about half the people out there right now are snoozing, or at least they should be. Well, in the couple of minutes that I have here before we begin our program tonight, which is connected to my guest, and I've been looking forward to talking with my guest for a while, because whatever is going on, it's not normal. Now, my guest may disagree, but I have a feeling, having kind of lived through an awful lot of this civilization, that whatever we're seeing now, particularly in terms of the electoral process, cannot be defined in any textbook as normal. I mean, you have one liar, demonstrably, running against another liar, demonstrably. Both candidates have the lowest poll ratings of any candidates, I think, that have ever run for president. Now, of course, we didn't have the kind of exquisite, in-depth 24/7 polling, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago that we now have. But we do have newspapers, we do have columnists, we do have archives, and when you look back at American history, even though some pretty terrible things were said about candidates, this one really takes the cake. Now, again, there are folks out there who are going to go, oh my God, he's going to talk about politics again. No, I'm trying to talk about an anomaly in civilization, where the one country on the planet, which kind of is the glue for the rest of the planet, circa since World War II, is in front of us, demonstrably falling apart. Now, one of the candidates claims that this falling apart covers everything. And the other candidate claims, well, except for a few little things here and there, everything is fine. Somewhere in between, perchance, might lie the truth. But I want to talk about tonight kind of deeper issues, like how did we get into this situation? Because as Shakespeare used to say, it's my assessment that the trouble is not in our candidates, not in our stars, but in ourselves. What is it that has predisposed us as Americans to basically run two of the most hated and feared candidates in history, in American history, against each other? So people are forced, depending upon whatever their perspective, to choose the lesser of two evils. This is not, well, I would say this is not healthy. And because health is the subject of tonight, particularly psychological health, it's going to be very interesting to see what an expert, and a cutting-edge expert, with his own model of what might be going on, has to say. I want you to all sit back, make sure you have something tall, and since it's summer, cool to drink, because the next 2 hours are going to be an extraordinary ride into places that we have not ventured before, places that, well, maybe no one has ever gone before. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. They keep trying to tell me, I think this is the Beatles. Sun is shining.
the sky. There ain't a cloud in sight.
And welcome back to The Other Side of Midnight. My guest this morning, Dr. David Pincus, is a licensed clinical psychologist in private practice and associate professor of clinical and health psychology in the Kreins College of Health and Behavioral Sciences at Chapman University in Orange, California. He first became interested in chaos theory. You're going to find out how chaos theory connects to psychology tonight. In a high school physics class while growing up in Wisconsin. The year was 1986, and while searching for articles in the school library for oral reports, his friend Chuck showed him a cover article in Scientific American by James Critchfield and colleagues from the Santa Fe Institute simply titled Chaos. His friend Chuck said, "This looks like a good one for you," teasingly. Except he was correct, and started Pincus on a track of inquiry that would become the focus of his career as a scientist-slash-practitioner psychologist. Over the next 20 years, first as a college student and later as a family social worker, Pincus continued to teach himself all that he could about chaos and related theories, that is, fractal, self-organization, and complexity. It was during this time that he first conceived of the idea of using models and methods from chaos theory and complexity to understand family dynamics. A major break fell in his lap when a few months after beginning a doctoral program in clinical psychology at Marquette University, he stumbled upon an organizational psychologist, Dr. Stephen Castillo, who was one of the pioneers in the use of nonlinear dynamical systems theory in psychology. And I think we're going to leave it there because there's an awful lot of terms that I'm sure a lot of people are kind of scratching their heads about. Dr. Pincus, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
May I call you Dave or David?
Dave would be great.
Super. Well, this is a subject that even now most people, you know, kind of treat as a kind of a tribal art, that there's some mysterious power that psychiatrists and psychologists have to figure out what's wrong with us,
right,
and fix it. When you got into your first clinical work, what was the most surprising thing about meeting with real people, real patients, as opposed to theory in college, that really upset you or surprised you or excited you?
That's a great first question. A lot of things, but I think what surprised me most was that the distinction between, you know, normal and abnormal really didn't seem to hold much water. I think that'd be my answer. That the people I was working with, I started out as a social worker in Wisconsin in 1992, and I was prepared for, you know, all the stereotypes that people would be crazy and they'd be all messed up and it'd be clear, you know, that I was the normal one, the helper, and that they had problems. And it really just doesn't seem like that. Everyone, it just seemed like we're all a lot of human beings, to be honest with you.
So there's really a gradient between normal and kind of really pathological?
Gradient is a great word for it. There's a gradient, you know, among and between us, and also within people. You know, I've been in some very strange situations, especially doing in-home work. I'm thinking up in Redding, California, when I used to do in-home work with people who, quote, had serious and persistent mental illnesses. And, you know, lots of people who hear voices and did all kinds of strange things and in a lot of ways couldn't function were perfectly fine in other respects.
Well, you kind of have to explain that, because hearing voices, I mean, I'm hearing voices in my ears right now, but yeah. I know exactly where they're coming from and they will stop when I turn this little switch. So what differentiates people who hear voices but also have other areas of their life where they're perfectly, totally normal, i.e. functional?
One fella comes to mind in particular. I'll never forget this guy. One of the first, quote, patients that I saw up in Redding, I'll never forget him. He was a patient, but he really impacted me a lot. you know, you try to stay professional, but also I feel like he was a friend. A gigantic man from rural Mexico. He was part native Mexican, I suppose. And he grew up with a lot of tribal knowledge and tribal rituals and things like that. He made some magical soup for me once that I was kind of afraid to eat for a while.
Peyote?
No, it was made with cabbage. It was basically vegetable soup, but it was very important to him that I try it. And it didn't do anything to me psychedelically, but he heard voices and he had post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, and schizoaffective disorder, which means he had manic episodes and he heard voices and he had delusions. The first time I met him, one of his delusions was that his penis had disappeared, and he was explaining it to me, and he asked me within the first 5 minutes, did I want him to take his clothes off and show me? You know, and I told him, no, I'm not a medical doctor, so that wouldn't be appropriate.
Well, wait. He's asking you to look at the evidence, right?
Well, yeah. It's just
he wanted someone else to affirm his belief that it was it disappeared.
He did. I was a trainee at the time, though. I didn't want to get in trouble.
Baptism of fire.
Yeah, so I just told him I believed his experience, basically, but as I got to know him over time, and I had to go see him in his home because he became too paranoid to come to the clinic anymore, he had a wife and a bunch of kids. And the wife was pretty typical, and they had a pretty normal life. A lot of his concerns were like a lot of, you know, suburban men, pretty typical stuff. He was just haunted by voices and strange mood swings and paranoia, but for the most part, he was pretty typical, and he taught me a lot.
In what way?
He taught me about life. He taught me about the importance of meaning. He taught me about, I mean, it's kind of hokey, but I'm a therapist, I guess it's okay, about friendship and love and trust.
That's not hokey.
Well, all right, good. and I guess about just connection and how important that is. So, you know, most of our work wasn't really focused on symptoms at all. He just needed someone there with him, it seemed like, as he went through his fits and his experiences and his strong emotion. And, you know, I don't know for sure. I don't have any measurable impact. We weren't doing any research, but, with him. But I think it made an impact. It appeared to.
You mean you working with him made an impact on him?
Yes.
But it's obvious that he had a huge impact on you.
He really did. I'll never forget him.
So would you say, and if I'm wrong, please correct, would you say that this encounter really kind of brought you up to the fact that the textbooks are one thing, but real people, real human beings are totally different? And you appreciated that human beings can be flawed, but still be totally lovable, likable, and admirable at times.
Yes. And, you know, all the best supervisors I had, too, knew this. And it's generally known by anyone who's any good as a psychotherapist is they tell you straight up, everything that you learn in the classroom, you've got to leave it at the door when you walk in. And they don't seem to have any kind of trepidation or contradiction when they say it. Because every human being is totally different. And so one of the weirdest things about psychotherapy. It's the most regulated, overeducated professions. And yet you're really learning how to tolerate uncertainty. You're not really learning any set answers. It's a myth. You know, when I meet people, you know, in social situations, cocktail parties and so on, they really do. They think you can read their mind and stuff, and they become often I like to tell them I'm a social worker because then they like you right away. But if you tell them you're a psychologist or someone's a psychiatrist, then they're turned off. But you really don't know anything unless they tell it to you.
I think the most lovable psychologist I can remember was Bob Newhart. Remember the Bob Newhart show?
Definitely. Yeah.
He really humanized psychologists and psychiatrists.
Yeah, he did. He was a good representation in the media, no doubt.
So, historically, how far back does the idea that that one human being can diagnose and help another human being through mental crises, how far back do we know that that goes?
As far as I know, it goes back to the start of civilization, but we used to be called shamans.
Ah, okay.
But you know, Frank and Frank wrote a great book in the 70s where they basically, they broke it down. It's an excellent book, The Art of Persuasion. They made the point that really psychotherapy is just applied rhetoric and that it hides under the guise of scientific validation only because, you know, we're secularized. But otherwise, we're basically shamans. It's just instead of a spiritual sort of stamp of approval, we get the scientific stamp of approval.
You get the shingle and the name on the door.
Exactly.
Okay, so what would you say some of the biggest problems of current psychological science are? And again, we're going to put the science in quotes because you said a moment ago that you entered a realm of uncertainty. And,
right.
And in the sciences that I am familiar with, physics, astrophysics, you know, that kind of thing, uncertainty is the thing you want to drive out.
Right. The biggest problem with psychological science, me and my colleagues would all agree, but we're serious underdogs. So we're pushed to the fringes a bit, but not as much as 20 years ago.
You mean the fringes of academia?
The fringes of academia to some extent, the fringes of practice. Mostly the scientific approaches to psychology are so steeped in the linear model.
Explain the linear model, please.
Yeah, the linear model is the idea that if you want to do research, you have to break things down into parts.
Oh.
That's reductionism. Mm-hmm. So it comes from René Descartes and then, you know, Newton. The Newtonian clockwork universe, that if you pull a clock apart and you understand all the parts, you know, a mechanistic view that the universe is like a machine. And so when they apply that to people, we can pull people apart. We can understand emotion as a separate component, different thoughts as separate components, behavior, you know, stimulus response. This thing that you experience causes you to do that. Very simple models.
You're talking, I guess, about Pavlov and his dogs and all that?
Pavlov and his dogs, yeah. And then Skinner after that with...
his mice.
Reinforcement punch. It's nice. It calms us down, makes us feel safe and comfortable. Especially in America, this approach really took off because we have a very practical approach here. We're can-do problem solvers, which is great. But in my view and... my colleagues in nonlinear science, we understand that this approach, what you end up with, you're almost like an autistic person. People with autism like to just take things apart. And then what you're left with is a bunch of parts. You know?
So you're saying that a human being, first and foremost, is not just the sum of its parts, it's more than.
Yeah. And the Gestalt folks back in the 30s said the same thing, you know. So the idea has been around for a very long time. It goes all the way in Western approaches back to Greek philosophies. There was Apollonian philosophy that was very linear, very simplistic, mechanistic, and there was Dionysian philosophy, which suggested that life works differently than that. That life, to understand it, you really have to understand connection among the parts, that's where life grows.
So when René Descartes, you know, set up his famous philosophy,
yeah,
and you, kind of this mind-body duality.
Yes.
How come hundreds of years later, you know, we've learned so much about everything, including what's really in the solar system, how come dealing with us, the central part of any apprehension of any reality, how come it seems to lag so far behind? Because I take it you don't believe that the body and the mind are separate.
No, I think anyone that really looks at that and still really believes that the mind and body are separate, that's its own kind of delusion. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense besides the fact that none of the evidence supports that idea. I mean, it's a little bit, you know, inappropriate, but I mean, the example I use in class is pornography. I mean, if you imagine something sexual, your body responds. If you want a more G-rated version, you imagine a lemon. Sure, a lemon, and the more I bring you, immerse you in the image of a lemon, and I can get anyone listening, I can say lemon, and a certain proportion of people will salivate. If I say, picture the yellow lemon, it's ripe, it's in your hand, then we get more people, and you slice it, and you see the juice, and it's glistening, and it's very ripe, and it's very sour. And these images, your body responds, and increasingly we can get people to salivate right over the radio. So how could the mind and body be separate? Descartes really was trying to not get killed. it was a life and death issue for him. He had seen Galileo go through trials with the inquisitors and eventually be killed as a heretic. And Descartes was, he actually died. He was imprisoned in house arrest for his ideas, even though he tried to say, well, you know, God controls the mind and science, we just want to look at the body. He wanted medical scientists to be able to work on cadavers, and the church was banning that at the time because they thought the body was sacred. So that's why he probably, I mean, the history suggests was motivated to make the mind and body separate. But here, over 400 years later, we really don't have much of an excuse to believe.
I was going to say, why are we still stuck with it? Because, anyway, why are we stuck?
I don't know for sure. Part of it is the difficulty getting rid of paradigms, you know, big ideas in science. Once they take foot, people's careers are based on them. But the weird thing is that psychology, where things are most obviously interconnected and in complex ways, where A causes B and B causes A and they both cause C, and then all of a sudden something happens and nothing is connected anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're complex and we unfold over time. It's so obvious in psychology, and for any therapist, they know this. But the scientific among us, we're the last of the scientists really to hold on to this strict linear paradigm. It's pretty weird. The physicists are way ahead of us, the chemists, the biologists, environmental scientists. So is
part of it because it's so hard to set up controlled experiments where you get a stimulus and a response that's the same every time?
That's part of it. Control, experimental control is a big part of it. I think the difficulty is part of it. People who are drawn to psychological science, there's an issue of math education, because the newer math that we use in complexity research, the physicists are very well trained in math, and we are not as much. So the math can be hard. The jargon can be difficult to get around. But I don't know. I think part of it is maybe what Freud, you know, coined a reaction formation, that we're so in psychological science. I think we're like the kid brother kind of phenomenon, where we want to appear scientific, so we don't want to do anything that looks interesting. You know.
But how can you be a scientist and not, when you're dealing with the most interesting thing on the planet, a human being? How can you be stopped by an artificial paradigm that is going to go away when the old guys, as Planck used to say, keel over anyway?
Well, I have a big soapbox on that issue, but I think there's...
Go for it. You got a platform here, 145 countries, take advantage.
Great, and we've got plenty of time still. There's a lot wrong with science in general, and I think it manifests...
One of my favorite subjects.
Yeah, it manifests especially strong in the psychological sciences. We're humans, so we're prone to human folly. So what motivates a scientist is their own local incentives. So you need to get published. You need to keep your job, i.e. tenure, if you're lucky enough to even be in a position to get that in academia these days. It's increasingly rare and difficult to get.
Tenure, you mean?
Yeah. So if you try to do something really interesting and groundbreaking and break the paradigm – you may really suffer in your career, in your status, in your, you know, it can be hard to get ahead. The truth gets kind of lost in the rat race of science. And increasingly these days, I mean, most people don't know this. Academics know this. In the last 20 years, I mean, when I applied for my professor job, I had a couple of publications coming out of graduate school, not in very prestigious journals or anything like that. And that was pretty good. And I was a good bet, and I've done a good job. I've had a good publication record. These days, we have our new junior faculty, even at a university like Chapman, which isn't, you know, a top-ranked national university. We've got people coming out of top programs with 10 publications already during grad school, and they have rankings on the journals based on impact factor, which means how many times does the journal articles get cited by other journals.
Tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour.
Oh, yeah.
My guest this morning, Dr. David Pincus, and we're discussing what's wrong with science?
Yes.
Starting with psychology. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. I am your host tonight and every night, or morning or afternoon, depending upon where you hang your hat, and we shall return. And that's the Doobie Brothers in the background. We're back with my guest this morning, Dr. David Pincus. Dave, I don't know. This is such a vast, far-ranging subject. Obviously, we're not going to get too deeply into it tonight. And I certainly am tantalized by your idea that science in general has some problems. But I'm going to resist going under that extraordinary diversion and get back to psychotherapy and psychology, because If we're trying to fix people and we have no specific criteria for what's wrong with people, how can you even begin? In other words, if someone doesn't edge over the line where they're out with an AK-47 shooting somebody, or they're locking their wife or husband in the bathroom and taking away the key, or they're beating the kids and the dog, you said before that the idea of a gradient is kind of operative now. Has it always been thus, or is this a new insight on behalf of you, or on behalf of the community, or on behalf of this conversation?
The gradient idea has been kicked around for a long time, and it's always lost. What we've got is a diagnostic manual that's based on, you know, in my and my colleagues' view, a mistaken idea that mental illness, that they're illnesses, and that they function like illnesses. And you can extend the idea to all the chronic conditions, which are really the costliest and most common health problems we have. Psychiatric problems are right in there. So you got diabetes, you've got heart disease, some cancers, overweight, especially child overweight, and then psychiatric conditions. And here's the basic problem. We've come up with an illness model because we think in terms of, well, you've got a germ or infection, and that comes from outside, and it causes, in a simple way, some kind of thing. Let's call it depression. And then depression leads to, in a one-directional kind of way, I've got this invisible thing called depression. We can't measure it directly, but we assume it's there. And it, in a one direction, causes these symptoms, like you can't sleep that well, and you're feeling bad about yourself. You might be suicidal, and you're tired, and so on. Here's a simple example of a better approach, which is a network model, which is a pretty basic nonlinear modeling approach. And think in terms of, you know, any of your social network sites, Facebook or whatever else you like, or just your group of friends. You've got a complex connected structure. And some colleagues of mine, especially over in the Netherlands, they're doing this work. Danny Boersboom is one, Angelique Kramer, there's a lot of others. What they suggest is the basic common sense idea that, hey, maybe these symptoms are actually causing each other, and depression is just what we call the pattern of symptoms causing each other. So if you don't, if you have insomnia, one of the symptoms of depression, maybe you're tired the next day, right?
Okay.
And then your mood goes down a little bit. And then if you're prone to criticizing yourself, you have a bad self-concept.
Oh, let me interrupt you there. I just saw the most amazing thing, probably on AOL or Yahoo.
Yeah.
And it said, I think it came from England, from the UK. It was in the Daily Mail. That's where it was. Right. And it said the single most interesting solution, efficacious, meaning it works, solution, to keeping a long-term marriage is not, you know, getaways, romantic getaways, not flowers, not expensive gifts. It said it's just more sleep. That apparently there's a study that couples that actually sleep more wake up feeling better about each other and their relationship and can kind of ignore the flaws and the usual disagreements and all that. And couples that are sleep deprived, they're really headed for the rocks. Is that backed up by anything you know?
I'll give you a nonlinear and skeptical reaction. It makes sense with what you're saying. However, I think if you looked at the details in terms of effect size is one way to measure how big an impact that is. I bet you it's pretty small.
I think they only had 64 samples.
No, my issue is how big an effect it does sleep make? My guess would be that sleep is what we call a hub variable, meaning it's a marker for a lot of other things. So if people are sleeping better, it's probably that's making the marriage better in one direction, but probably the marriage, if your marriage is good, you also sleep better. It goes the other.
Yeah, of course.
And they feed on each other over time. Also, probably if you're sleeping better, neither of the partners has an anxiety disorder or depression or schizophrenia or something else. Probably they both have better physical health, which is also helpful. So what we in complexity science tend to do is not, and I think it's an interesting result, by the way, but it's a starting point. And then you say, well, what kind of things might be connected to?
I think they had them, each of these couples keep a journal so they could actually track.
Right. But better sleep is connected to a lot of things. It's a hub variable, meaning it's a marker for physical health, social health, and psychological health.
Did you guys steal that from the airline industry, the hub model?
Oh, no. But that's the thing about complexity science is it's ubiquitous, meaning that it's everywhere. Hmm. And the coolest thing for me about finding fractal patterns that underlie personality, social dynamics, physiology, or network models that can be used to make diagnostics better and more person-specific is that these models are used across all of the sciences, and they're all over the place in nature. If you look out the window, the only things that you see that are in straight lines and perfectly proportional are things that are man-made. Everything that nature makes is complex, and it's usually in a network structure, and it's usually fractal, meaning it's branch-like.
Funny you should say that, and thereby hangs a tale and a totally different show. Okay, let's get back to networking, because you're modeling human beings internally as a network of what and who?
Traits. Yes, a network of traits.
Okay. Please define.
The most dominant approach to understanding personality, the five-factor model, says we've got five basic traits, introversion, extroversion, and so on, you know, how agreeable you are, how open you are to experience, and so on, and that these are perfectly separate. And in fact, the scientific methods from which these were derived, the statistics are made so that you find separate factors. And this is useful to an extent. But what you lose is the complexity and the individuality of people.
Okay, you raise an interesting word there, statistics.
Yes.
Is it true, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, that because one human being is so incredibly complex, the way the psychological sciences have progressed is to take large groups and try to do statistics on this thing, that thing popping up, so that we're looking at averages opposed to the unique human individual.
Yes, and that's one of the central problems that we complexity researchers have, is that approach really destroys the phenomenon you're trying to look at.
Wow. So it's really reductionist, and it's completely antithetical the idea of really grappling with psychology and psychiatry and humans, it's totally antithetical to Arthur Eddington, who was a famous British astronomer in the last century, who said, gentlemen, of course he was talking to other gentlemen, yes, gentlemen, you do not have a science unless you can express it in numbers. So would it be fair to say that psychology and psychiatry have attempted to become scientific by getting lots of numbers?
Perfect. Yes. Exactly. Wow. And to get at precision, and so we look across individuals and we look at the average. But, you know, anyone listening knows there is no average human being.
So if I'm a therapist and I'm dealing with a patient, I'm trying to bring the combined wisdom of a field that is averaging like crazy, and the guy or the gal sitting in front of me is obviously unique. How is that at all applicable to what I'm trying to do, which is to help that person?
You've got it. That's why the clinician has to leave everything they learned at the door when they walk in the office.
Oh, my God. Talk about a psychological disconnect.
Yes. It makes me nuts that people continue to do this.
Is that a technical term, nuts?
It means frustrated and baffled.
Okay, so what's the solution?
The solution is one of them. There's a lot of solutions, but we need better models. What the network model, let's say, approach to psychopathology would say, yeah, you have these symptoms, but the symptoms cause one another. And the constellation, the pattern of symptoms hanging together, defines this thing we call depression. But there is no really depression. There's just a group of symptoms that cause each other. And then we can start to do something really useful, which is to look at what's the hub system, again, borrowing from the airlines, I suppose. If you want to take out an airline, you know, or God forbid you're a terrorist, you want to hit a hub of a network, right? Because it does the most damage. Mm-hmm. So me as a clinician, when I have a client come to my office, I want to see what is the symptom that's the most stuck and that has the greatest influence on all the other symptoms. And for some of my clients, it might be sleep. For some, it might be the way that they relate to themselves. For some, it might be their marriage. For some, you know, it's different for everybody, but I've got a verifiable, quantifiable science that I can still use, which is to measure how do symptoms interact.
So how do you get this data? Do you ask them to fill out long questionnaires? Do you just have conversations and you take notes?
Well, no, I haven't done the network and the psychopathology work, but my colleagues that do it, what they've started with is looking at the diagnostic manual itself. And very simply, as a proof of concept, they took all the symptoms in the manual and they made a network model out of them. So they looked at the symptoms that occur across diagnoses. Let's say insomnia is a diagnosis for both anxiety and depression, right? Mm-hmm. So those are links in the network, right? And then you've got these other symptoms that are connected to depression, and other ones like worry and physiological stress that are connected to anxiety.
And how do you quantify these very qualitative terms?
They map it all out in a networking software program.
Oh, so this is now software?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Absolutely. You build the network just in a modeling software. You can do it in R statistical package. There's others, MATLAB, that cost money. But R is free and open source, and that's been really helpful for pushing the science forward. And they mapped it out, and then what they wanted to see was, because it's science, can we predict the prevalence rates of different disorders, and can we predict severity based on the network model that we built based on the symptoms in the diagnostic manual? And sure enough, the fit was really high.
Because science is nothing if it's not prediction.
We need to have some prediction, yeah. Absolutely. And we need to fit better than the linear approach, which you know, even though it's ridiculous, the idea that there's invisible depression that you can't measure directly and all the causes one way towards symptoms, we have to verify that it works better. And so they've been doing that work. They've done it in personality structure. They've done it in diagnostics. And then what they do is they use an approach called experience sampling, which technology has moved forward because people have cell phones now, smartphones. And what you can do is ask people a few times through the day, where are their symptoms? And you can track the intercorrelations among symptoms over time, how they influence one another, in both directions, how insomnia causes fatigue and vice versa, right? And they found a really simple explanation for why some people get stuck and are less resilient and other people bounce back. Connectivity is the problem. When symptoms are too reactive to one another, when they cause each other too intensely, then they get entrenched.
You mean when there's a positive as opposed to a negative feedback? Negative feedback is when
you
something...
You got it. Control theory. You got it.
Okay. Well, sorry. Let me explain for the audience. If something weird happens yes. and you don't want it to happen, you have to create a system where the weird thing will kind of damp out and you go back to normal.
Yes.
In unusual, anomalous situations, the weird thing will just get bigger and bigger and bigger and ultimately destroy the machine. I'm using machine analogy.
Snowball.
Yeah.
A snowball gets bigger and bigger for those in the cold climates as it rolls downhill because the more it rolls, the more snow it picks up. So these symptoms, they cascade, they feed on each other, and then the person hits the bottom of the well and they're stuck there. And you don't just have one cause, you've got many causes. And everything keeps everything else stuck.
Hmm. So what's the way out?
The way out? Well, one way out is to aim for, if you can find a hub and you can change the hub, then you aim at the hub. Another way out, it's a little broader view on things, but you have to look more globally at what's the function of structure and flexibility in people's lives, because everybody needs...
Oh, you got to define those terms, please.
Structure is things holding together, keeping things in place in everyday life.
You mean it's, like our normal routine?
Your normal routine is one way that we get structure. Your core beliefs are your structure. Your values can provide structure, right? So one of the newer ways that behavior therapists, they don't understand complexity science, unfortunately, but they stumbled on it intuitively, is what they'll try to do is a lot of people will get structure out of their lives from their illnesses. It comes to define who they are.
Oh, wow.
So then they know who they are, right? I'm sick. I'm depressed, right?
Wow.
So what you do is you try to replace that with freely chosen values.
Well, wait a minute. Hang on a second. If people are sick and they tell all their friends, and now on Facebook they can tell the world, don't they get a lot of positive feedback for being sick? Oh, you poor dear. Oh, right. We feel so sad for you. Oh, is there something? In other words, it becomes a mechanism of attention.
It's a cancer on the self.
Hmm.
Cancer is the most dangerous when it takes over too much of a vital organ and starts getting its own blood flow, so that if you take the cancer out, you've got no spleen or kidney or whatever else left. The same thing happens with the sense of self. So if you come to define yourself based on your pathology, and pain is a classic example, chronic pain, and it's not the people's fault. It's just it's pernicious. It's no more their fault than when cancer takes over a vital organ. But eventually you come to define yourself based on your pain because it's always there and it becomes a big part of who you are. The more of yourself it takes over, the more difficult it is to pull out, because nobody wants to be left without a self, because then you're really crazy.
Right? But wait a minute. If you have a healthy individual, we'll assume that most of us are kind of healthy,
uh-huh.
and something happens, there's a trauma, so the pain suddenly envelops your life.
Right.
Why is there a predisposition to go with the pain and use that to define you, as opposed to the person you used to be and somewhere there still are?
It, for most people, it happens either because they were set up beforehand with lower resilience, or because...
Now, please define resilience.
Resilience, as I define it, is basically connection, broad, distributed connection on the biological level, the psychological level, and social level. The social level is the easiest to understand.
Yeah, when you say connection, I'm thinking connecting with other people, but you're talking there's an internal connection we're missing.
There are. But the easiest ones to understand, you're right, are the social connections. People are much more vulnerable to trauma if they're alone and isolated. And that's why war is especially tough, right? Because it cuts off your social ties. A lot of people who have especially severe trauma, they want to get back into the war because that's where their social ties are. That's where their sense of purpose is. That's another thing to connect to on the psychological level. And they get back in, stateside, and they're disconnected from family and friends. They don't have the same set of experiences. And that's why talking about the stuff actually helps, because not just because it's cathartic or it releases pressure, you know, like Freud used to think, like a valve. It's because it can reconnect you and reintegrate you with other people.
Okay, let me stop you there, because there's a huge social problem which most Americans, let alone the rest of the world, don't seem to be really aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but because of the recent wars, Iraq, Afghanistan, the suicide rate among military-serving members, male and female, is going through the roof. And I don't remember the same from the Korean War or World War II or World War I. Isn't it incredibly ironic and a tragedy that in an era of more connectivity, i.e. social media, the folks coming back are more isolated and wind up blowing their brains out?
Definitely. Totally agree.
And what's the answer? What's the explanation for we're immersed in a sea of social media and we are more isolated in many cases than ever before?
I think in the question you just answered it, I totally agree with you. We're more isolated than ever before.
But why?
Why? There I'd have to speculate, but I'd suggest that...
That's what we do on this show a lot. Okay, go
great.
Ahead.
I think it's manifest destiny. You know, we were supposed to hit the West Coast, and what does the West Coast represent but freedom and individuality, which I love, by the way.
Right.
So I'm a patriotic American, and I love freedom. But the downside, Viktor Frankl said it, you know, best in the 50s, is it puts a lot of responsibility on the individual. And when everything's going great for you, you know, individuality and being able to do whatever you want whenever you want is great. But when you experience trauma, you know, something that overwhelms you, then you really need the connection side.
Did you see that story about the woman who was released from jail and committed a deliberate felony to go back in? She could not cope?
I didn't, but I, you know, there are so many examples of that. Yeah, that happens too. Absolutely.
Because she had a connection, a system that she could rely on inside, and outside she was basically on her own.
Yeah, and I'd speculate that she knew who she was in there.
And she was smart enough to know, I can't handle it out here, so she went back.
Right.
And doesn't that indicate mental health?
Yeah.
Really? I'm serious.
Absolutely. It's functional.
If you know you can't handle society, but there is a place in society where you are yourself and you function, I mean, to me, it seemed a stroke of mental genius.
Yeah, the problem is we see individuals, we don't see the social fabric. So for this woman and for a lot of people, there's huge holes in the social fabric. So they migrate towards somewhere that they are connected.
Now, are those institutional or are they part of the American exceptionalism mythos that we're all rugged individualists and that's why everybody has to have an AK-47 in case the government turns tyrannical?
Oh, it's probably the downside of that second thing. I mean, again, I'm a red-blooded, you know, American, so I like the rugged individualism. But we don't see the downside of it. And you can't impose it from above, by the way. You can't really engineer it. So I don't know what the solution is exactly, because we can't go back to living tribally, even though people did it better. I mean, they died much sooner, but...
Well, that's due to other factors.
Right.
Just technology, or lack of technology.
Yeah, yeah.
Why can't we have a useful hybrid where we have the best of the high-tech 21st century, but we also take from the shamanistic cultures where there are extended families and support systems and people who have down days? You don't feel guilty if you have a down day. You take a down day and you bounce back the next day.
That would be the best. I love that idea. I don't. It would have to emerge, and hopefully the science, the complex system science, can help us see that, and then we don't have to engineer it, but we can make conditions where it can emerge. That would really be ideal.
When you say emerge, doesn't somebody have to actually stand up and be a pioneer and say, damn it, this is what we need?
No. The cool thing about emergence is it's defined based on something that grows from the bottom up. So it's a distributed cause among people. It's more of a movement kind of thing. It's like a bird flock, you know, the patterns in a bird. or even how, you know, on a human level, how people cross the street, right? If you've got a narrow walkway with a lot of people in it, everyone automatically organizes. You walk behind someone and you form lines because it moves more efficiently.
Are we nudging up against Prigogine now?
Oh, beautiful. Yes, Ilya Prigogine, Nobel Prize winner, chemist.
Yep, self-organization.
That's right. And what we're doing is applying that to social systems. That's mostly where I've focused. Yeah, self-organization, the idea that without a leader, well, here's a good one if you want to spin into politics, because I know the show likes that.
Eventually we're going there, but
the idea would be that Trump didn't get a whole bunch of supporters and make them, you know, Trump heads, that the supporters made Trump.
Yes, yeah, oh, that's my model, totally. It's not Trump that's a problem, it's us.
Yes.
So then the problem is, what is so wrong with us that we're fastening on a guy who actually disses Gold Star mothers?
Or what do the people who support him really need?
Well, that's the bigger question. What is it that's missing in this society now that ultimately people, a lot of people, roughly half the population, voting population, thinks they're finding the answer in Donald J. Trump?
Love it. And you use the word the answer, and I that's probably a big part of it, is what they need is certainty.
Well, they want a messiah. They don't want process. I mean, Trump stands out there and he gives absolutely zero plans, unlike Hillary, and that's the other antithesis.
Yeah.
And people are flocking to him because they see all the stuff that they think is wrong, and they just have a guy saying, I'm gonna fix it. In fact, he said categorically at the convention, I alone can fix it. That, to me, is so pathological that it's almost, how is that even American?
Well, I have a hard time not letting my own politics get in there.
I'll tell you what, we're at the top of the hour. Right. We're going to have about 30 seconds here. Yeah. I hear music playing. Is this Justin Bieber? No, I guess it is Justin Bieber. Love yourself, baby. Okay.
How did that happen?
Because M is very bright. Okay. So you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning, Dr. David Pincus. And we're discussing the problem with us. Remember that great cartoon some years ago? I guess it was Pogo. We have met the enemy and he is us. We're going to talk about that when we return. So don't go away.
Maybe you should know that my mama don't like you, and she likes everyone. And I never like to admit that I was wrong.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. My gosh, this tower is going really quickly. 1 hour gone, one to come, actually about 5 minutes now, and then we have another break. So what can we do in this 5 minutes? I think before we get into the political thing, which is an absolute, you know, they talk about rabbit holes. This one is in an infinite rabbit hole. It's almost like a black hole. In fact, it was so weird because tonight at the top of the other side of midnight, if you go to Radio with Pictures, there's a headline, Donald Trump's Black Soul. Someone was very, very elegant in their wordsmithing. If the problem is us, how did we allow this to get so out of sync that we basically have two pathological liars running against each other, and we're forced because the system we've created to choose one? Isn't that the definition of pathology, David?
Well, it's pretty narrow, but it's, you know, how long have we had the two-party system?
156 years, I think.
Yeah, it's not terribly flexible. So that, you know, I do define rigidity as lower resilience.
So again, if you have a system where the two choices are terrible, how come, you know, Gary Johnson or the gal running on the Green Party, whose name escapes me at the moment, how come alternatives are not bubbling to the surface if we're so innovative and creative as Americans, and we demonstrably are? How come we've left all that creativity at the door when it comes to the most important part of how we run our society, which is how we function under the consent of the governed?
as a complexity researcher, I would start by guessing.
Jill Stein, I'm sorry, I just got a note from him. Okay, don't want to miss Miss Nine. Okay, go ahead.
I would guess that it's a bellwether or a sign of what's going on collectively. So the polarization that's gone on and whatever's driving that is probably driving this polarization in our political system. It's a reflection of that. That's what I would guess.
So you're saying the system is seeking more and more polarization, opposites, as opposed to consensus or springing up with a third option or a fourth option?
I would think that it's a stress system. We do have the pre-existing constraints, which are the two parties. It was, you know, politics isn't my area, but on the right, in the Republican primary, we had huge diversity. So we did.
But 17, yes.
Yeah, and on the Democratic side, we really didn't. It was very narrow.
Well, we're supposed to only have one. And the Bernie phenomenon, to me, is telling us that at some level, there's health there, Dave. There's health. Because the Bernie thing was, we don't want either. We want the third option. And, of course, in that two-party system, the third option has been, maybe permanently, maybe not, kind of squashed for this cycle.
Yeah, you know, a political scientist visited Chapman last year who had an interesting model. Instead of a straight line left and right, he was making it into a circle. And if you look on a circle, it might explain a bit why Trump and Sanders kind of come close together, the common denominator being someone outside the system that has a populist, you know, vein to them. At some point, the idea was that conservative and liberal meet if you go far enough to the extremes.
I heard years ago, back when, you know, we were all scared about communists and would hide under the bed every time the word was uttered,
right,
that there was this circle in terms of communist and ultra-conservative, that essentially they were the same religion, only masquerading under different flags.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to take another break here. We're at the 5 after. My guest this morning, Dr. David Pincus, and this is fascinating because I'm trying to lay foundation with the help of Dave. So when we get to the exciting part, which is how do we fix everything in this society, we actually have a basis of discussion. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. And welcome back. My guest this morning, Dr. David Pincus, and we're discussing what's wrong with us and how we may be able to fix what's right with us. So getting back to your basic model,
okay,
that we're a complex of networks, and
yes,
that there's no such things as healthy or insane. It's a gradient between. And the most insane are those that act out not only against themselves, but against other people. Is it possible, Dave, for, quote, normal people to, as the cliche goes, snap? Or is it only restricted to certain personality complexes that are kind of totally under stress, and you can see that, and you can predict? The reason I'm asking this is there's a huge debate in the country now about guns, as you know.
Yeah.
And the idea that gun control and mental health go hand in hand. We want background checks. We want to make sure people are not, you know, mentally whatever. And if what you're telling me, if I've internalized it properly, that kind of analysis of a social situation would be almost impossible because anybody can become aberrant depending upon the level of stress.
I agree. Stress is a big part of it, but the key word, as a therapist, one of the great things is you get to be a good listener. I love the word snap. You use the word snap. Snap is a model. It's a nonlinear model. It's something breaking. You apply pressure, stress, right? Mm-hmm. Like buckling of a beam.
Mm.
You don't see anything until all of a sudden it snaps. A linear approach suggests that as you increase pressure, something changes in a proportional way. Little bit of change in this, little bit of change in that. But much more often, it's a snapping phenomenon. That's part of the predictive problem. The other is low base rates. Even though we
what does that mean, low base rates?
That means that even though we see them on the news, so it looks like it happens a lot, it's incredibly rare, these shootings. Even though they're increasing in frequency, it's very hard to apply, especially linear scientific approaches, traditional science.
But see, that's what Trump has been so incredibly skillful.
Never happened.
That's what Trump has been so incredibly skillful at manipulating and using, because he takes these, you're totally right, incredibly rare phenomenon.
Yeah.
And he extrapolates to where people literally are afraid to walk out their front door because a terrorist is going to get them.
Right. There's a term for that. It's a basic cognitive bias. It goes back, you know, Daniel Kahneman had a cool book in the last few years about fast and slow thinking, but he won the Nobel Prize a couple of decades ago, coming up with the basic problems we have with human thinking, cognitive biases. One of them is called the availability heuristic. It's why people are more afraid of airplanes than driving in cars, even though cars are much more dangerous. It's because you can picture crashing in an airplane much more clearly. So, you know,
well, it's the what's keeping it up thing. I mean, I used to have a very, very, very smart, rational girlfriend who was terrified of flying over the ocean. Because she was trying to sleep and she imagined there's miles and miles of nothing beneath me, beneath this seat, beneath the under part of the airplane. There's nothing, and it's like it terrified her.
Right. The basic problem with the human brain is it's adapted to manufacture meaning and patterns even when they're not there. So if you can picture it, you know what I mean? It's what you can picture that you believe. Statistics, I mean, people hate them for a reason. They're totally counterintuitive for the brain. So, yeah, someone like Donald Trump can take advantage of that. But, you know, all politicians take advantage of it. The case examples are more compelling than you know, science. So, anyway, the problem with the shooters and terrorism and everything else, well, we were talking about shooters, weren't we?
People. Mm-hmm. Yes. And the idea that you can solve it by simply having better mental health information that keeps them from getting guns if they have mental health problems.
Yeah, I really don't think that would work. Here's the problem. We can picture in our minds that people with mental health problems are more dangerous, but the statistics tell us otherwise. You're much safer with someone with a mental illness than someone who doesn't, on average.
Why? You
know, most crimes...
Why? This is a why question. Why?
Because they're scared to death. I mean, people who have schizophrenia, it's the scariest sounding mental illness. They're totally freaked out. I mean, they don't want to hurt anybody. They're afraid you're going to hurt them. You know what I mean?
Okay.
But the thing is when they do a crime, they do some shootings, but when they do, it's way scarier because they don't do it for any reason that makes any sense. So it's very unpredictable.
You mean they snap?
They snap. Exactly. So, you know, as I tend to look at context. I think the bigger problem is our social fabric, and that these individuals, you know, are they snap because they can't connect anywhere. And I know I'm oversimplifying and overusing that connection theme.
Well, this kind of connects to the other discussion we had in the last segment, which is why do folks coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, why are they so disconnected in a sea of social media where you have people tweeting when they go to the damn John?
Yeah. Well, that kind of connection might be, you know, it might not be very nourishing. That might be part of the problem. So it gives the illusion of connection, but you don't really experience it on the deep level that you need. I mean, someone on social media, you have to feel that someone will be there for you. It's hard to get that through Facebook or whatever your social media.
Well, the whole premise of Facebook, you know, you got 10,000 friends. Give me a break.
Yeah, it's a souped-up Rolodex is what it is.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the folks coming back, part of it might be that we've got a disenfranchised professional army. Back in World War II and even Korea to some extent, it was the whole community was behind these folks, and you knew who was going, and you knew when they came back. And the parade thing is not just a symbol. It's a communal ritual, you know, to bring the person back in. And it, not, I mean, we're so far from that now. It's almost like we're hiring people.
But see, if we know all this, how come there's such a disconnect between this database, which goes back hundreds of years just for America, and what's going on now, the political policies that seem to be directed to drive the problem through the roof as opposed to solve it? I mean, how long have you heard the problems of the VA? Why can't they solve the damn problems at the VA? It's been decades.
Again, I think it's over linear engineering. They try to find one simple solution rather than looking at the whole system. And it's hard to get rid of a whole system.
Well, you know, but we have stunning examples of institutions, government institutions, that actually create incredible success through whole systems analysis.
Yeah.
And let me give you one example. Right. NASA. NASA would never have gotten us to the moon without a whole systems approach. In fact, systems engineering was basically born in the space age to solve incredible intractable problems of a whole different range, 90% of which we didn't know the answers to. I mean, when they designed the foot pads for the lunar module, we didn't even know whether you could put a pad on the moon. Tommy Gold said we'd just sink down into miles of deep dust. We solved all that, and we came up with a stunning success. How come we can't engineer our society a little better to find these problems that are so perennial? And the reason that there's such a restive mood to go for a guy like Trump?
Boy, there's a lot in that question, but
well, we have time.
I think at least a decent piece of it is because getting to the moon is a specific goal. So it's a clear goal that everyone's working towards, and it has a solution. The strange thing about a lot of the problems that we're talking about the way that we wage war and the way that we treat vets and so on in the VA, there isn't a solution. It's what, you know, there's a term from the 70s, I forget the authors, but they call it wicked problems, which are problems with many, many, many causes, many potential solutions, but none of them is perfect.
Okay, so going back to Ilya Prigozhin, how come we as a culture, as a civilization, haven't seen this in our families, in our friends, in our, you know, the folks we know, cousins, whatever, and we haven't self-organized solutions from the bottom up?
Oh, boy. It's a hard question to answer. Possibly, what you get in complex systems is the emergence of boundaries and local rules. So part of the problem might be that everyone's incentives are all fouled up. Like, you know, politicians, for example, or political parties, are their incentives really aimed at doing good? Or are they aimed at keeping people in office, you know, or grabbing power? And people focus on money in politics and so on, but you might need to broaden the lens a little bit and see that bureaucracies, they become naturally corrupted. After we went to the moon, we didn't disband NASA. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
The bureaucracies get a life of themselves, and then the incentives are, let's keep the bureaucracy going. So that a big part of both of the parties is to keep the party going, not to nominate the best candidate.
So again, I'm going to ask the awful question, what's the solution?
Well,
you thought you were just going to have a kind of a free ride in the middle of the night, David, right?
The earliest part of the morning. There probably isn't a solution. I think that's probably the answer.
Okay.
Some problems don't have a solution. And politics has got to be one of them, if there is one.
So is it possible that we're trying to deal with the 21st century complex civilization with a 17th, 18th century constitution?
Yeah, probably. If we keep looking for a or the solution, we're probably not going to get anywhere. You use Bernie Sanders as an example for those who support Trump. You know, I don't myself.
Well, there are two organic philosophies that are really opposite, but they're organic. They're from the bottom up. And for God's sake, look at what one of them gave us.
I've got a great colleague named Glenda Oyang. I got to give her credit for this one. I was at a conference with her this past weekend in Salt Lake. She suggested that when you have a situation that doesn't have a problem and you have high uncertainty, which is what we're talking about.
You mean doesn't have a solution?
Doesn't have a single solution.
Oh, okay, okay.
What the best strategy is to embrace the uncertainty, realize it's there, realize there isn't a solution. And what you do is you have to remain engaged, seeking information, and rather than make a decision that's going to solve the problem, you make a decision that's going to get you to the next step to get more information. So perhaps it's not a solution, but a strategy would be that if people who care about the country and care about us as Americans, that we stay engaged, we keep trying to inform ourselves and get to the next step so that when a solution emerges, you'll see it and you won't miss it.
Have you ever been invited to testify on Capitol Hill?
Not yet.
Okay, because it seems to me that this kind of thinking is exactly what the legislators who are grappling with the adjoining issues of terrorism, random acts of violence perceived, blacks against cops against blacks, all of that mishmash, that they need input that's outside the tetrahedron thinking.
Yeah, I think you're killing it right now. I absolutely agree. And, I've seen some of this coming up in the political discourse. The war on fill in the blank model seems to be getting worn out, which is great.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, war on drugs.
Remember war on drugs? Yeah, Nancy. Oh, just say no.
Yeah, and you can hate drugs and think that it's a real problem, but the delusion that there's a solution that it's going to be simple and it's going to be linear, most of the time for problems like these, it's not. So, it'd be great if it was. And someone who sells it as it is and it's going to be simple and I'll do it and I'm the only one that can do it, that can be quite compelling, but it's probably at its basis.
Okay, that's an incredible segue, Nancy. Say no to drugs to my next question, which is, how big a role do drugs now play in psychotherapy? I know from personal experience from friends that if they go to a therapist, they don't get conversation, they don't get notebooks, they don't get long-term association, they get drugs.
Well, just to clarify it first, though, if they make it to therapy, they're an unusual case and they're pretty lucky. For example, anxiety disorders are the most common problem people have in our culture across a person's lifespan. 40% are going to have a significant problem with anxiety.
How would you define an anxiety disorder? Because everybody's anxious at some time.
Right, and you need to be, but extreme.
It's kind of survival. If you're not aware that you're in danger, you're probably going to wind up dead at some point.
Yeah, and that's right. It's evolutionary, and that's why we have anxiety disorders, because it's better for nature to have some people with anxiety disorders than have us walking off cliffs and things. It's extreme, unrelenting anxiety that causes suffering and interferes with functioning. It can be extreme worry, or it can be compulsions, habits you can't stop doing even though they don't work, or worries in your mind, that you can't get rid of and that interfere, or it can be,
Again, in your gradient model, the most extreme is what they call OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, where it's like people have to wash their hands 10 times a day, stuff like that, or vacuum the carpet at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, and the obsessions are even worse for a lot of people, where you've got a thought in your head that's the worst possible thing in the world that you can't get rid of. Contamination, but also like newborn mothers that can't stop thinking about killing their child or something like that, or if you're in love with someone.
Oh, my God. All right, let me depart again, and we've added Michelle to the call. I'm going to add her to the conversation secondly, but I want to ask this question. There was a woman apparently in Alabama who literally put her 14-month-old baby in an oven, in a 600-degree oven, and broiled him to death. She wanted parole. The parole board said no. She's obviously not well. What's wrong there?
Well, that's the opposite of OCD. Let me make that clear. It's real common obsession, meaning obsession is defined as the most horrible thought that a person can think.
So obsession can only be negative?
Obsessions are the most intensely punishing thought.
Well, because I've been accused of an obsession with life on Mars for decades. Anyway.
Right. That's a positive obsession. But yeah, obsessions in OCD. Newborn mothers thinking about killing their kids, they would never do it, ever. By definition, it's the thing they would be least likely to do. People in love, one woman I saw, she was thinking about killing her partner because she loved him so much. It was the worst thought she could ever have. And then when she would be logical and say, well, I wouldn't do it, I love him, then she'd think, well, some people snap. Or maybe when I'm asleep, I'll sleepwalk and do it, right? And you think the thought. So anyway, OCD is actually pretty rare. More common is just general worry about a lot of different things to the point where you can't sleep. And you
back to the gradient.
Back to the gradient, yes. So about 40% of us, and panic disorders are terrible too, by the way. That's about 10% of the population going to have those.
Really? That high?
It is. Actually, 50% of us will have at least one in our lifetime, and then only one in five has it recurrently to the point where it interferes.
Now, this is panic based on nothing but panic.
It's a misfire in the brain where the brain thinks it's suffocating when it's really not.
Okay, is that one manifestation or is that kind of a cause of panic?
That's the definition. I mean, a lot of things can trip that misfire, you know, background anxiety or stress in life or timing. You know, genetics is a piece of it. But, you know, people with OCD have a more reactive CO2 detector in the brainstem.
Oh, we know that as a scientific fact now.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, we've known that for a few decades. It's not the only cause, but that's why like being enclosed in places like a car with all the windows shut tends to trigger panic attacks.
So wait, you're saying claustrophobia actually has a physiological basis?
No, panic because the CO2 levels go up in the car and that can trigger panic attacks.
But aren't people who are claustrophobic kind of on the verge of panicking if they can't extricate themselves from that small space?
They would be, yeah, but technically that's claustrophobia. Panic attacks come out of nowhere.
So they violate the gradient model.
The gradient model is that, you know, 50% of people have panic attack one point in their life. That's normal. But then some people really get stuck and have lots of them. So that's more.
Is there a preference for age?
Yes. It's kind of interesting. Children can't really have panic attacks until you hit adolescence. The reason is because you have to have a good imagination.
Yeah.
And children can't worry enough to have a panic attack because they have to picture, what if I have another one, and see it clearly enough, and then that triggers the next one.
So their time sense is more present-oriented as opposed to future.
You got it. Yeah, because they're limited cognitive development. Yeah. Usually they come about in adolescence or early adulthood for the first time.
Okay, we're approaching the bottom of the hour again. It's amazing how this hour, 2 hours, is flying.
Yeah, it's fun.
My guest this morning, Dr. David Pincus, and we're discussing us, POGO. And M says we're so cute. She has an interesting way with words sometimes. So we shall be back. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Something without wanting love bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be.
And we are back on the other side of midnight, although actually on the other side of the world, it's just after sunset, and our favorite guest from Japan is with us. Michelle, what do you have to add?
Oh, sorry about that. Yes,
that mute button is such a hang-up. Yes, I know.
Yeah, well, I was in another window and then, oh crap. So, you know, I had a couple questions. One that was kind of a comment, but I wanted to throw something in with what you were talking about. You said something about children not really having panic attacks. And I did want to ask you, what would cause a child in their preteen years, say 6, 7 years old, to want to commit suicide for no real logical reason, no real sort of... Right, yeah, not like my parents, you know, are doing something horrible to me or anything like that. Just as a child, you know, anything makes them just really, really go kind of... Their mind kind of goes out there and they are trying to, you know, harm themselves at that age. What do you think could cause something like that?
Well... Again, the scientist wants to say it's speculation, but I'll share a couple of anecdotes I probably shouldn't.
And get just a little closer to the mic, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. The anecdote I'll share, which is I probably shouldn't, is I was one of those kids. Did a weird thing when I was 6. Some older kids told us that gooseberries would kill us, so I didn't believe them. And I honestly, I had the thought, well, I'm young still. I'm not that attached to this world. And me and my buddy ate a bunch of gooseberries and laid down and waited to see what would happen.
Good grief, David.
The cool thing is, and this could be constructed in my memory, but before I opened my eyes back up to live, I made a commitment to myself that I'd really have a good time in this life and not take it too seriously and try to hold on to the 6-year-old part of me. But anyway, that's a story for another day. My son, I'll share, I probably shouldn't. He went through this a couple years ago. He's 9 now. When he turned about 7, he started talking about when he was really upset wanting to kill himself. So I think from your question, you're talking about that kind of thing where child's not otherwise depressed and not having, you know, serious environmental problems or family problems. They just go through a phase kind of thing, you're saying?
Perhaps. I suffered from this when I was young, and it did actually last into my teenage years, partly just because things got circumstantially worse in my life, but they weren't necessarily bad at the time.
Yeah.
But like a little thing like, we were playing a game and I did something wrong in the game and the teacher yelled at me, and immediately I was like, I need to, like, there was this feeling inside me that said, I need to atone for this with my life. And so I started like hitting my head against the wall.
Oh my gosh.
And I still remember doing this, and the teacher like immediately ran and grabbed me and tried to stop me. And I would do stuff like I would, there was a book called, I won't tell the name of the book because it might be a spoiler for anyone, but I'll tell it anyway. No, everyone's read this book. Have you read Bridge to Terabithia? Do either of you know that book?
I haven't.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
no, wait, why would David have read it and I wouldn't?
Well, it's a children's book, I think.
It's so sort of a children's book,
I think I saw the movie, to be honest with you, but then I know.
Okay.
Well, in the book, it was kind of about two kids that are, they have their own imaginary sort of Narnia world. They're really big fans of Narnia, and they're escaping from all their problems by going to this little world they have out in the woods, and it deals with sort of growing up and that kind of thing, but then something really tragic happens at the end. And I would go out, and I would go out into the field behind our school where we would have, you know, play and stuff. And I would pretend that I would be that character. And, I would pretend that I was, you know, dying on the ground. And, you know, a teacher walked up to me one time and said, you know, what are you doing? And I didn't realize that there was anything wrong with this, that this was not normal behavior. So I just told her.
It was kind of cosplay.
In a way, yes. But it was always characters who were dying that I was doing this with. And I never could quite figure that out. And even to this day, I still don't have a very solid self-preservation mechanism.
According to M, it's been adapted for screen twice in a 1985 PBS TV movie and
surprised.
A 2007 Disney feature film.
Yeah, and the Disney field tried to play the fantasy elements from what I've heard and didn't really focus on the human story of it as much. But it was really traumatizing for a lot of the kids. But and I've never quite been able to figure out what would cause a child, you know, at that age to deal with that kind of feeling, other than other issues in my life. But
yeah, other than the other issues, and, you know, for other children, there may be more serious problems going on in their families and so on. But I give you a three-part answer, and I'm guessing this fits you pretty well based on the story you just told, which would be being precocious. And I'm not saying suicide's a positive thing, but sometimes negative things can come out of positive development. So being precocious, so a little ahead of your time in terms of you got to have a big heart and a good imagination. Those would be the three things I'd suggest. So you've got to be a little precocious to come up with that kind of solution. You've got to be creative to imagine it and to imagine it as a solution. And you've got to have a big heart. And especially, I'll go on the soapbox again a little bit, but in our culture, big-hearted children, sensitive kids have a hard time. And the research really does them a disservice. They call it a 5-HT polymorphism, which suggests...
Oh, my God, you better define that one.
It's a serotonin. It's a gene that transcribes serotonin receptor functioning.
Oh, so it's chemically based.
Yeah, they suggest that there's something wrong with the serotonin system. But that comes from, again, this over-linearized mindset.
Would that be overproduction of serotonin?
They don't know.
Well, I saw another story the other day. Somebody somewhere, there was a major Yahoo story about legalization of marijuana, and someone said, some doctor, I think, said, well, you don't want to do that because it depresses serotonin and it produces short-term memory so you can't remember anything. So if serotonin is that malleable, is it too much or too little that leads to these issues?
I don't believe it's too much, too little, honestly. I mean, a turkey.
So you don't believe the model?
A turkey dinner will overload you with serotonin.
I thought that was tryptophan.
This is true.
Because of the tryptophan. But what I'm saying is it's only negative in our cultural lens when a child is very sensitive. So that teacher, when she said that, and the environment of a school system, and I'm soapbox again, but it's built in a factory model where everyone in that classroom is the same age as you, and it's kind of a little rat race.
Well, you know, this was a small Christian school with only 16 people in my whole class, so it was a super political rat race in that sense.
Yeah, so, okay.
It was its own little
bit. That was
a
microcosm community, so everybody knew everybody and all that. I mean, that sounds like a negative in that situation.
Sounds like it. Yeah, so you were intensely ashamed, and you were created, which was partly because you're sensitive. You had a big heart. I prefer to call it big heart than emotionally reactive, which is the term from
buzzwords.
The weird thing is you know, sometimes kids develop different parts of themselves at different rates. So some kids, their heart develops faster than their impulse control.
Well, if we're complex networks, why would you expect that we would all develop at the same rate?
Right, even internally.
Yeah.
Piaget called it décollage, you know, back in the 30s. The idea that a lot of times kids are just, you know, the horse race of different traits and things, it's like a building under construction, so you're fragile. So you had a big boiler system, you know, your sensitive heart, and it wasn't well contained yet with the rest of your personality, so you came up with this solution. And there wasn't much to stop you from really thinking about carrying it out, probably. So that'd be my best guess, is that it was positive traits that, you know, just were part of development, and the social environment wasn't there to really support and contain you.
Okay, I want to ask a taboo question, David. Okay. Put you right on the spot. And Michelle, please stick around. Okay. And by the way, for other people who want to join us, the phone number is 505-796-8802, 505-796-8802, or on Skype, Enterprise Mission, or The Other Side of Midnight. Okay, here comes the taboo question. Yeah. David, do you believe in reincarnation?
I'm totally agnostic. I think it's possible.
So if reincarnation was real, if we are serial virtual reality occupants of these robots we call bodies,
Is
it possible, as there are claims out there, that some things like what happened to Michelle and what happened to you and what happened to your son are part of a previous set of lives where, again, you snap because things just go wrong and it's just too much?
Yeah, there's a lot of Hindus in the world. I'm not going to try to argue them out of it, you know?
Okay. But sure. I'm just wondering, like, if from your... go ahead, Michelle.
Do you remember floppy disks? I mean, I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
The big ones.
Yeah.
I fix up old computers as one of my hobbies. And I've got some falling apart here on my table. The old floppy disks, if you could format them, right, and you could erase them, and it would erase all the data. But what a lot of people didn't realize is that usually when you formatted them, all it did was erase the data at the beginning that told where all the files were. And then as you use the disk, it would write new information. But the old information would largely still stay in the area. It's just that the little bit that told where that data was at was erased. And I feel like, to a certain extent, perhaps our human, you know, if reincarnation is real, perhaps we're like those disks. And sometimes all of the data doesn't get fully erased. And sometimes we pick up or little bits of code that are still there activate when they shouldn't be.
This is in the reincarnated model.
Yeah. So that maybe we're like disks, and we've got all this information, and that when we come in, we're supposed to have, you know, a wipe, or certain things are supposed to be cleared out, but maybe not everything gets cleared out, and so old data is kind of seeping through at times. Who knows?
Yeah, I really wish psychological science was looking more at questions like this, right?
Mm.
Well, again, it's back to opener versus closed systems. Are you of the opinion that consciousness is resident within this, you know, 1,600 cubic centimeter thingy we call our skull, or are you open to the idea that maybe consciousness is apart from this physical reality, and we're almost like VR programs where when we die, we just go back to source, and then we reprogram a new android to go through the next level of experience?
Certainly open to it, definitely. My co-author, Anish Shaikh, my former teacher and co-author on Guided Imagery for Pain, is a proponent of that perspective. There's a whole area called transpersonal psychology which suggests that the science has a hard time answering, because, you know, his metaphor that he threw at us in class, he said, you know, what's your evidence that consciousness resides in the brain? And we all talked about Penfield and similar studies where, you know, if you electrically stimulate the brain in particular areas, you can trigger memories and so on. He said, but doesn't the same thing happen, and this was, you know, 20 years ago, with the TV antenna? You mess with the antenna, the picture changes, but you wouldn't suggest that TV is making the images.
Ah.
So he suggested more of a receptor model, that the brain is so complex and it's got its organization as it does, so that it can pull consciousness.
Again, did you see that story the other day where someone, I don't remember the details, but he had probably had a headache or something, and he went in to have a scan. And they found that 90% of his brain is missing, and he was totally functional, a dad, doing everything, until he had occasion to have his brain scanned, and they said, oh my God, there's no there.
Yeah.
How do you explain that from a physiological model?
Well, they try to do it with neuroplasticity, but
another word we should define.
The idea that there's nothing really going on at the level of neurons, it's the relationships among the neurons.
Oh, it's the network again.
The network, yeah, the brain is definitely a network.
But if you have too few parts of the network to function, I mean, I have a computer and it's supposed to be, you know, this functional, and 90% of the memory is somehow eliminated, cannot be accessed, that computer's not going to function normally.
Right. The brain doesn't work like a computer. That's it. But, no, I'm with you. But, here, I'll name drop. I love this. My my great uncle Oscar Sugar was a pioneer in hemispherectomy, and not only splitting the hemispheres and brains, he was a neurosurgeon back in the 50s and 60s, but he was the first to successfully remove half of a child's brain because of untreatable seizures, and the child lived and had normal intelligence, you know, into adulthood. It's a wild thing. No, I'm with you. It's baffling. But again, it really frustrates me that psychological science doesn't examine the most interesting things.
Again, M has written to the rescue. The man lives in France. His name, I think, is Fiona MacDonald. He was reported on the 13th of July of 2016 on Facebook. Lives a normally healthy life despite missing 90% of his brain.
That's awesome.
Isn't it? And that's not the only case. Art did a show years ago, Art Bell, where he actually, I think, talked to someone who had been clinically diagnosed as missing a large chunk. And you say that the Thurgood model says neuroplasticity, like a word will really explain it.
Yeah, they try to say the functions migrate, but that should not work with an adult. It you know, children are much more plastic, they say. It should not. I'm throwing that in my intro to psych course for sure. I'm going to look that up and throw it.
Cool.
It
really,
I heard a story that was in relation to that, where some woman a long time ago had the similar thing, and they had determined that her brain matter had grown between the layer in between the skull, I believe, and so it was literally growing around the side of her head instead of inside the area.
Wow.
Inside the brain case, you mean?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Fiona was the author of the article. I don't know the name of the man, so he may be a little hard to find. But David,
just for Google.
I was going to say, Google is your friend.
Yeah.
So I had one last big picture comment that I wanted to make before I leave.
Right.
If it's all right. You talked a little bit earlier.
You may not leave, Michelle. Nope, you have to stay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, the show's only got a little bit left anyway. You talked a little bit earlier about social media and some of the problems with that and this problem with connection. And you also talked about Trump and why Trump is so huge. I think one of the things that people forget so much about social media is that it's, while it has this big sort of social connection and it connects people in ways that it couldn't do before, it doesn't connect them in human ways. And it's very difficult sometimes for people to look at the internet and see a person on the other side. And I've been watching this documentary about the old BBS days back in the 90s, before they had the actual internet.
I love the way you say the old days.
Well,
I remember BBSs.
For the internet, that is the old days, yes. But for us, maybe not. But and one of the things that they kept talking about was that in those times with those BBSs, everyone knew each other. And these people could be far, far away, but then they'd have these meetups where they would all get together at, you know, a restaurant or something, and they would meet the people from their BBS.
That was kind of the basis of the Art Bell chat clubs.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that's missing from our current social network in a lot of ways. We have all these people, but for the large part, we never meet these people. And especially with Twitter, and this is a big one, I think. With Facebook, it's a little bit different, but with Twitter especially, you just see an avatar and whatever pictures they choose to pose. And so when you're talking to these people, for a lot of people, not for me, but for a lot of people, it's very easy to forget that they're human beings. They're not robots just responding,
yeah.
That they're not digital. And that dehumanizing factor, I think people have severely underestimated that dehumanizing factor. And I think that's part of the reason why Trump loves Facebook so much. Twitter so much, yes. It's because he can say anything he wants on Twitter, and it doesn't connect to him because people don't connect. I think people don't connect to the human. They connect to Donald Trump as sort of an avatar for these feelings.
Yeah, but he does the same thing on television and interviews and in rallies. I mean, he's not any different on Twitter than he is everywhere
else.
Well,
no, but what I'm saying is that Donald Trump is not really a person in this campaign. He's an avatar for our feelings.
Oh, how interesting.
And, And Twitter is the best outlet for that, because Twitter is such an avatar-based society anyway, that people don't even care about who's being hurt in the process of what's going on.
Oh my God, Michelle,
they just react.
I see several PhD theses on this. Really? Yeah, David, isn't that amazingly interesting?
It is. And
he's an avatar for our worst nightmares and all awful fears.
Yeah.
In fact, I was hearing commentators this afternoon say, if you contrasted the two conventions, Republican and Democratic, one week apart, sequentially, back to back, the Trump one was dark, 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 and the Democratic one was light, light, light. Again, polarization, as we've said on the show a million times, and I'm not going to bore you with the physics model. I'll wait till you come back for your next visit, and then you'll hear all about hyperdimensional physics and consciousness. Mm-hmm. But not tonight. Michelle, what an interesting idea.
Well, you know, when I look at Twitter and I look at people talking on Twitter, they see Donald Trump and they see Hillary Clinton and they see them in such caricaturized ways. They see Donald Trump and they can immediately go to some sort of black and white thing of he's just a racist and that's it. And then they can feel like they can sum him up in that. And you can't sum up someone like Donald Trump in that way. But because they've sort of digitized everything into this sort of binary thinking of everyone who doesn't agree with me is evil. Everyone who agrees with me is good. I can destroy all those other people and it doesn't matter because they're just avatars. They're not humans and we don't care about their human lives. That I think that's why the violence, especially the online bullying and all the other things, the violence is ramping up is because people are starting to dehumanize individuals because of this effect.
Michelle, let me extend what you're saying. I definitely agree. It explains a lot. You know, I was hearkening back earlier today to the good old days when I may not have liked Reagan that much, but I voted on platform. And Democrats, they've got a strategy of, well, they're making a cartoon out of me, Hillary says, and here's the real me, here's the cartoon. You know, there's so much that seems to be getting stoked up, almost like, you know, crowds with pitchforks and torches about the personality of the candidate. And I honestly think it's a huge problem, right? I think that's what you're saying. It's a distraction.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, how can you have representative democracy, the consent of the governed, if the governed are all nuts, if they're simply going for an archetype?
But it's a twisted sort of Frankenstein version of a prom election, though.
Yeah. Okay, Darren, we only got a couple minutes left here. Darren has a very important question. How is the best way to treat depression or anxiety without drugs?
Psychotherapy.
Oh, okay.
It works.
I can attest to that.
Yeah, it really works as well as meds. On average, the relapse rate is lower with psychotherapy, but meds work quicker on average. With psychotherapy, eventually you say goodbye to the therapist. Meds, you usually have to continue. So there's goods and bads. If you're severely depressed or anxious, you might need meds for a while. But otherwise, psychotherapy, and I was going to tell you the point before, you know, it's so common, 40% of the population in a lifetime going to get an anxiety disorder, but only a quarter of them ever see a therapist. By and large, the vast majority are getting meds, and they're getting them from their primary care doc more than psychiatrists.
So they can't sleep, they take an Ambien, that kind of thing.
Yeah, or the worst is you get addicted to Valium or another anxiety drug. Usually they give antidepressants for anxiety. That's the good treatment. But, you know, the meds, it's all driven by economics. It's really a problem. And knowledge. You know, you don't see commercials for psychotherapy like you do for meds.
No. I mean, I have a long psychotherapy story about a friend of mine, but we'll save that for the next show because – basically, she was in the clutches of a psychotherapist that just was sucking her dry for money.
That's a problem, too.
And I fixed it by simply lifted her out of that situation, completely changed her environment, and she never had to go back.
3 to 6 months it should take. It doesn't need to be forever. Once a week, shouldn't break the bank. And, yeah, go to someone who's well-trained who you feel comfortable with.
Yeah, I used to take Wellbutrin and Effexor. And I don't know if you're familiar with those or not, but
sure.
I really, really couldn't stand it. I felt like a zombie walking around. And yeah, I mean, I didn't have the feelings, but I didn't have any feelings. And I felt, on some level in my brain, I just said, this is not a way to live. Hmm. And it took me getting into someone who was a trained, a really good trained psychotherapist at the college that I was going to,
yeah.
who was free, was yeah. part of the college system, and who I worked with every week. And even though it was a group setting, I still felt like I got what I needed out of it.
Yeah.
And this was specific too, because this was a transgender group, and I can't say anything more than that.
Okay, guys, I hate to tell you, but the show's ending.
Oh.
We're almost out of time. David, thank you so much. Thank you, Michelle, for joining us again. David, we've got to have you back because I have a million other questions, like the efficacy of ecstasy in psychotherapy situations.
Yeah.
I have personal experience in California with someone who used it and it was then cut off at the knees by being Schedule One. The other question is, what will happen if we expand the use of medical and recreational marijuana? And we can't answer because the music's playing. So until next time, on the other side of midnight, next episode, tomorrow morning, we have open hailing frequencies and maybe a surprise or two. Thank you, Dr. David Pincus. Thank you, Michelle. And everyone listening anywhere on this rotating globe, join Club 19.5 and don't miss anything. Till tomorrow morning, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.